Welcome and congratulations. You have made it through 13 episodes now of 1865, and you've just listened to the finale of the Edwin Stanton portion of that arc. This is really kind of the end of this main story, but don't worry. There's bonus episodes yet to come where we dive into some of the backstory of the conspiracy with Booth and the conspirators. But this was the big finish, the grand finale, the effort to impeach Andrew Johnson, the wrap-up of the story, and the saying goodbye to our lead character, Edwin Stanton. The two guys that wrote it and broke all our hearts are with me now, Stephen Walters and Eric Archilla. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Thank you, Rob.
What a long, strange road it's been, my friends.
For us or for Stanton?
Both. There's some parallels there. I think the consequences for us are just being exhausted and a little punch drunk. His were a little more, the stakes were a little higher for his for his journey and the country. But
agreed.
A lot of real history went into this episode. So let's talk about what the real history of these moments are. And it starts with a flashback to the Battle of Gettysburg the night before,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, the eve of the Battle of Gettysburg, which this is based on a real conversation that happened between Lincoln and Stanton on the eve of that battle.
That's right. This was recounted by Stanton later about this conversation that he and Lincoln had and just the gravity of the moment. Not knowing if they were going to win or lose, that this is a make or break moment for the Civil War. So, Steve, why did you hone in on this moment for this episode?
In the real history of what happened in that conversation, I believe they made the decision at Stanton's urging that they replace the current general who was going to be fighting that battle with a new general. And it was because that general had just lost. It suffered a major defeat not long before the Battle of Gettysburg. And Stanton felt that his spirits were broken and that the spirits of the men were broken. So Stanton put a new general in place to kind of give them light. Yeah, General Meade. I think in my first pass on it, I did get into that. And I think that's what I made the scene about the kind of like leaning into the idea of like, hey, you know, sometimes when things are failing, you need to like take a new tack and a new approach. But then I kind of went in the other direction at Eric's suggestion and made the scene about this idea of surrender, this idea of what happens, because my question was, well, what happens at the Battle of Gettysburg if it goes the other way? Well, what happens is that the capital is surrounded. And if the capital is surrounded, it's possible that they could lose the war because General Grant's forces were way too far away. And the Confederates were on a winning streak. There were real stakes of life and death and, you know, victory or defeat. And so it was this question of surrender, which I think kind of helps thrust Stanton into the final motif of what this series is about.
This promise to Lincoln that I will never give up and never take the easy way out and I will not surrender is going to have huge echoes in this final episode of the Stanton arc.
Because all the stakes lie on this impeachment vote.
So let's talk about this attempt to impeach Andrew Johnson.
Well, of course, the founding fathers set up in the Constitution parameters for the impeachment of a president. But this is the first time that it's ever been brought to bear. Andrew Johnson is the first president impeached in United States history. It really does pass the House. The articles are adopted. It really does go to the Senate for a trial. And Andrew Johnson is acquitted. He is found not guilty of the charges against him by one vote.
By one vote.
Yes.
Which again points back to the issue of who is it doing the voting? Those Southern states that have full voting rights are in on this vote. And that was part of the reason that Stanton was so adamant. You know, not that he necessarily saw impeachment on the horizon, but he was like, we're not going to put the country in the position that I think we need to be moving, that he, Edwin Stanton, thinks we need to be moving, if all of these Southern states are brought back in with full voting rights, and that, in fact, does happen.
One of the other pieces of historical fact in this episode that, again, we use, give a little creative license to, but the speech that Bingham makes, which is very well done, Rob.
Why, thank you.
Is about 90% his real words. The truth is that was part of his closing argument, but his closing argument lasted for like 4 days or something. So we needed it dramatically to be at the beginning of the episode. So I sort of co-opted his closing speech and made it part of his like opening, you know, salvo.
I could tell it was definitely historical, but the user up of syllables, there was some turn of
phrase.
Yeah,
the eater up of syllables.
Eater up of syllables.
Eater up of unconsidered trifles or whatever. He really said that.
So after that powerful and emotionally moving speech, you have a scene where Johnson has taken an interview with the reporter, much to the chagrin of his handlers and Wells, that, you know, again, history imitates, like, oh, no, we don't want you to do one-on-one. We don't want you to do one-on-one interviews because there's no telling what you might say. And he, again, kind of puts his foot in it again. Did this interview actually happen?
Yes, a lot of interviews happened. And, you know, and in the same way that Wells wasn't a part of the decision to fire Stanton and replace him with Lorenzo Thomas, Wells was also not happy about the fact that Johnson was running his mouth to the press. And the things that are in that scene, which I think is really hilarious and very, and almost to the degree of being upsetting, topical and relevant. He called Lorenzo Thomas a drunk. He called him a queer old gentleman. I mean, his basic point was like, hey, I didn't do anything. It's not my fault. You know, and, you know, getting angry with the reporter for asking questions
The man that he personally selected for that.
Yes,
position.
That's right. And the line he says, if I used any rough expressions, they were put into my mouth by my enemies, is a thing that he really said. And that was in response to him, you know, speaking in a racist manner out on the road when he was making these speeches.
So in that interview, Johnson says he's not worried about the impeachment hearings at all. He thinks he's got it. But we see in conversations with Wells that it is, in fact, a very close thing. We see in conversations with Bingham that everybody knows it's down to one or two votes. What actually happens? That now is the next question. Where went the impeachment vote?
And again, that feeling like we had in that opening scene of this is the eve of battle. And we don't know which way this battle is going to go.
There was a lot of real history in this episode that I was completely unaware of that happened in this time period. And one big piece of that is revealed is this, is that there were troops amassed on both sides leading up to this impeachment vote.
That we actually got very close to a second civil war, basically, because the sides were so polarized between Stanton and Johnson.
So that all, tell me about what actually happened in terms of the militias. And
well, you know, there's a lot of conflicting information out there about it. What is absolutely true is that the newspapers were reporting it. So people believed it. So we don't know. I don't think we actually 100% know the number of troops that were called up, but there were a lot of reports that we were on the verge of a civil war. So whether or not Stanton and Johnson in the real history of it actually did call up on Johnson's side the militias and on Stanton's side the standing army, we don't know. But we know that that for the people of the time, that the tribunal certainly had stakes that were that large, that severe. And there's also a lot of information in here that is, you know, speculated upon. One of those things that there's a lot of controversy swirling around is this idea of bribing votes, bribing senators for votes. In the information that I've done in my independent research, the number 150,000 is there for a reason, and that's because that's how much they raised. And actually, according to David Stewart, who wrote a book about the impeachment, it was actually Secretary Seward that was the one pulling the strings on this slush fund, this $150,000 slush fund.
Oh, so he had fully jumped ship at that time, as we see takes place over the course of this episode, that he loses face with Stanton.
Yeah.
But in the at least that research, it was Seward that was raising all of this money.
Yes. So we don't actually know that, you know, the whole thing about Seward finding out about Mary and then flipping and then him, you know, using that information to push Senator Ross over the edge. That didn't happen. I mean, it's impossible that it did. That's our invention and that's fiction. But what we do know is that Secretary Seward was definitely one of the ones pulling the strings on the backdoor dealing and the vote buying efforts. It was Seward. It was Treasury Secretary McCullough and Postmaster General Randall. The three of them were the ones like from inside Johnson's cabinet that were
raising that slush fund,
wheeling and dealing. Yeah. And raising that money from rich people in the South.
The way that we learn about that in this episode is that Robert Lincoln returns for a brief cameo.
Yes.
Again, well done, Stephen Walters, voice of Robert Lincoln. But
Thank you.
But what is that based upon?
Well, they actually were, on the anniversary of Lincoln's death, they were erecting a statue, not the Lincoln Memorial. It was just a separate statue that was going to be in front of City Hall. We were looking for a creative way to impart this information, that there were these backdoor dealings going on, that Johnson was trying to buy votes. And once I found out about the statue and the dedication, I was like, Robert's the perfect solution to this thing, especially because he's married to Mary Harland, who is the daughter of a moderate Republican
senator. So one of the people who would probably have been targeted with this slush fund, it makes a lot of sense that that would be somebody.
Potentially, yeah, potentially.
And Harlan was upset because he was one of the cabinet members that left. He was the, I think, Secretary of Interior, left Johnson's office in 66 because of political differences. And so he wasn't too happy with Johnson and would have been happy to rat him out if he heard that those dealings
got wind of that. And we just like hearing that Robert finally got engaged and had a happy
to another daughter. To another,
but still, like, you feel bad for the guy with everything that happened with Lucy. So I'm glad that Robert Lincoln found love.
So am I.
There's also a lot of controversy around the last vote that made Johnson acquitted. Senator Edmund Ross of Kansas apparently was taking money from Johnson. There's also people that say that he, which to me is right on point with our story, that the senator did not want Johnson to be replaced by a radical Republican. And
was that Benjamin Wade?
Benjamin Wade.
Yeah.
Who was the next in line to be replaced if he was taken out.
So the impeachment effort fails. He stays in office. Johnson stays in office by one vote. Stanton is talked out of the barricade that he has made for himself in the office, and it kind of seems like all is lost. Also, he doesn't get on the Supreme Court. Johnson was going to put him on and doesn't do that. You know, you assume that there was a last-minute bargain in the story, and I think that's a really nice story point. We don't know that necessarily that was dangled in that moment.
No, in fact, we know it wasn't, because we know that Johnson had his ability to nominate people to the Supreme Court taken away from him by Congress.
Oh.
Yeah. We think Merrick Garland was bad. The Republicans made it. At the time, there were 10 circuit courts, so there were 10 justices, and they added one of the 10th one during the Civil War that gave Lincoln another justice. But then they removed 3 justices from the court to make it a max of 7, and there were 9 living at the time when Catron died. So basically, 2 more justices had to die before Johnson could appoint anybody.
Oh, because they were lifetime appointments, but when they passed, those would not have been refilled.
So they said, not only are we not going to have hearings on the person you called forward, but then they said, we're not going to hear hearings for him. We're also going to take away 2 more in case 2 more die. You're not getting them back.
That's how committed we are to not letting Johnson.
You see, Eric, Republicans have been depriving presidents of their constitutional right to appoint Supreme Court justices since the 1860s.
Even when back when the Republican Party was on the same ideological side as Stephen Walters, he's not above using that against Eric Archila in today's context. And I love it.
Then once Johnson was out of office, they added 2 justices.
They added 2 back. And Edwin Stanton did eventually get his nomination
from Ulysses Grant,
who by that time had grown very close to Stanton. Grant started off on the other side of the political spectrum, and through all of this time with Johnson and Stanton and the battle between them, he kind of changed allegiance and grew very fond of Stanton, and to the point of giving him the Supreme Court spot.
And sadly, I believe it was 5 days, right?
Is there 4 or 5 days before he passed?
He was never able to sit on the bench.
Yeah. After he was appointed, 5 days later, he died.
And I think it's a really poignant kind of the obituary that we have in the episode, kind of the wrap up on Edmund Stanton, I think is really moving. What about some of the other characters? Tell me what happened, first of all, to Langston, for example.
Langston's story was one of the reasons why I think we chose him in the first place, because he is the epitome of the repercussions of Stanton's failure to stop Johnson and how the South rose up with the Black Codes and later the Ku Klux Klan. Langston ran for Congress later and was a member of the first group of Black congressmen to serve the United States, and was served for Virginia. And first of all, he wasn't even allowed to take his seat because they fought it in court for about 18 months. And then once he was finally able to sit, he sat for 2 years. He and a group of, I think it was 4 other Black congressmen. We don't see another Black congressman or senator for another 50, 60 years in the United States because of the ramifications of the South being empowered to manipulate votes and scare voters away from polls and everything that Stanton knew was going to happen if he didn't protect the freedmen.
And then on the complete opposite side of the political spectrum and the spectrum of privilege, Andrew Johnson has a very active political life beyond his tenure in the White House. He becomes, I believe, the only sitting president to return to the United States Senate. It's kind of interesting with Andrew Johnson because the man who stood with the North against secession, who becomes a traitor to his own people in the South, who is vilified for that decision, ultimately becomes their hero and returns to Tennessee a champion of the South's cause. He's honored with parades. He's beloved. He's adored. And he goes back to serve in the United States Senate after his time in the White House to continue to fight for the principles of the antebellum South.
I guess it's because of when I grew up and the way that was not palatable to the, you know, history book writers of the 70s. I don't ever remember hearing anything about Andrew Johnson. I think he was in the list of good, bad, or indifferent presidents. I don't ever remember hearing Johnson even spoken of. And so it was amazing to me to find out how impactful his presidency was, that he was the first to be impeached, that he had such a huge impact on the way Reconstruction happened, and that it's just not a topic
anymore.
In fact,
I feel like in the back of my mind, I vaguely remember in like middle school hearing that Johnson wasn't liked because he was too hard on the South. I honestly think I remember hearing that.
That was also written about him. You know, it was written about Johnson that in the early days of his presidency that he was too punitive. And that's in part because of the death of Mary Surratt, because he did, in fact, sign that execution order and chose not to spare her life. But as time marches on, and with the benefit of hindsight, modern historians, I think pretty much you can't say all historians agree that, but I would say that most historians would probably put Andrew Johnson on the list of top five worst presidents. I think some would put him at the top of the list.
I think you would.
Perhaps.
So I have learned an awful lot over this process working with you guys. So I want to thank you guys for the history, for the lessons that you have taught me in the 2 years that we've been working on this, and really the 5 years that I've been involved with the play and learning different pieces of this story. So as we come to the end of this section of it, I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Rob.
I want to remind everybody listening that there are more episodes. They are on a slightly different timeline, examining a different side of this story. We're going to learn a lot more about the conspirators, about John Wilkes Booth, about what happened in that boarding house that Mary Surratt owned. We're going to hear some of those conversations. It's a fascinating, fascinating ride. But as we are finishing up with this part of the story, I want to get you guys kind of big picture takes on what have you learned and what sticks out to you now telling this story in 2018 about 1865.
I would say personally, as somebody who tends to lean more conservative, reading the words of the South and of people that are advocating for fighting for what they fought for during this Reconstruction time, it was very eye-opening to a lot of, I think, code language that is still used. I wouldn't say that modern people really understand that they're repeating the same things oftentimes that the South was saying at the time.
For example, like things like states' rights.
States' rights.
States' rights as code for I want to be able to own other humans.
Well, not even even after that, states' rights saying you can't take my property to help these people that we held in servitude for so long. States' rights that the Congress shouldn't interfere with our lack of prosecution of these people and the things that we're doing to them. It was eye-opening and kind of broke my heart a little bit.
Yeah, the states' rights versus government overreach is one thing, but states' rights versus human rights is a very different discussion.
And so not to say that modern conservatives are wanting to reinstate the South and do all the horrible things that they were doing. It made me kind of hone in on when I hear political conversations, some of those keywords that have been repeated for so long.
Well, and I don't think it's true that every conservative wants to reinstate those things. But I do feel that there's a pretty strong argument to be made, and I'm not even sure that you would have to argue it, that there is a rising tide of white supremacy and white nationalism creeping into our culture. And of course, it's crept into our culture and into the global culture at many points along the way, not just in the 1860s and the time that predated it, not just during Jim Crow, not just during the Black Codes, and not during the era leading up to civil rights. I mean, it's come and gone in every civilization from, you know, mankind's inception. That doesn't make it any more palatable or just or acceptable.
But would you say that there's a rising tide of it or a acceptability of it that allows people to get out of the shadows?
It's less deeply hidden. Yeah, that was the thing that I was going to say. They're emboldened. It seems like in this moment in 2018 that people seem way more free to say the terrible things that they're thinking. I don't know that there's necessarily more of them thinking that, but they certainly seem to be more free and willing to talk about it.
I've said it before earlier in a couple of our talkbacks, but it's been weird through this process that as we've been writing it, current events have been happening that mirror what we're doing. And when we were getting into, I think, starting the podcast process is when all the Confederate statue talk came up and the tearing down of the Confederate statues or should they stay and the lost cause conversation. It was like deep into what we're researching and talking about. And it's just
happening
weird
right now.
How the podcast has timed to that conversation.
Well, and there are a multitude of historical aspects of this story that resonate today and that ring true today. But in the sort of, you know, big picture sense, the part of it to me that resonates the most is that words matter and people in positions of power through their words cause other people to behave in certain ways. It's like that old saying, attitude is reflective of leadership. I believe that that's true. I think that, you know, it's a dishonest argument to say that, you know, a president can say something and be the cause of something happening. It's not that simple. But certainly when a man or woman in a position of power speaks to those who look to them for leadership in a certain way that is devoid of humanity or devoid of any sort of historical perspective or devoid of any recognition of their own privilege and blessings that have been heaped upon them. Absolutely, that pollutes our culture, and absolutely it pollutes our discourse. And that's been the biggest awakening to me. I said early on, and I think one of the first of these episodes, I said it's like Battlestar Galactica. All of this has happened before, and all of it will happen again. What I can't figure out is the fact that we keep repeating this vicious cycle. Certainly the arc is bending towards justice. I'm not such a cynic that I don't believe that things are getting better. But as we keep repeating the same cycles of destructive behavior, what I can't tell is that a good thing or a bad thing? Do I take comfort in the fact that we've had worser times when I compare them to today? I don't know. I don't know that I do. I don't know that it's a comforting thought for me. I think maybe it's not a comforting thought.
That we haven't learned as much as we think we have learned. Yeah. Well, I'm speaking of what we've learned from this process and this inside the episode arc. In episode one, inside the episode, we talked about this is a question of Edwin Stanton, and does the ends justify the means? He did a lot of things in what some, you know, everyone listening to this can make their own opinion, but some would agree he did things for the right reasons, but he did a lot of things that we could say were wrong and the mistakes were made. So big picture, as you guys look back on this fascinating, fascinating human being who had a huge impact on American culture and who has been widely forgotten, what is your wrap up on Edwin Stanton?
I believe that this is a non-answer in a way because I don't think I can answer that question. But what I will say is this. In our political discourse, as we look to history to be a guide, as we look to what's happening today and hold the mirror up to ourselves and to the world that we live in and the society that we live in, what is absolutely required for each and every one of us as Americans is radical empathy, including for those with which we disagree. That is what I believe.
And maintaining a certain standard on ourselves of what is right and just. Not looking the other way when our party is committing atrocities or breaking the law or bending the law just because it's politically expedient for us.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting, too, that inside of 1865, there is this constitutional crisis, right? There's the president wants one thing and there's Congress wants another thing. And that's because our Constitution is imperfect. It's a flawed document. It's contradictory in many respects, right? Well, Congress, their job is to control the purse strings and their job is to pass laws. The president's job is to enforce those laws. But the president's job is also to protect the country. So what happens when all those things don't line up? What happens when those things are in conflict with one another? Well, the answer is, well, if the president steps over the line, he can be impeached. And we have this imperfect, flawed process to self-correct, for the institutions to self-correct, and for the powers and checks and balances inside the separation of powers to root those problems out. But it's an imperfect system, and it's a flawed system, and it requires all of us as participants in a democracy to do what Eric just said, which is to be consistent, right?
Yeah, to hold everyone to the same standard, even if they're the people that we agree with or we don't agree
exactly.
with.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
And the other thing to remember is that people are flawed. And
except for Eric.
Except for me. People are flawed.
Yeah, they are.
And what system of government better protects us from flawed human beings than democracy? What form of government better suits humanity and the flawed people that we are than to give a billion checks and balances on each other and make people fight for that power in a way that's messy and imperfect, but at the same time prevents someone from just taking over and being a totalitarian.
Well, and it's only, you know, and where things get really complicated are when the mechanisms of those checks and balances and the mechanisms of our institutions and the mechanisms of power are weaponized against human equality. That's where things, you know what I mean? Matters of justice. That's where things get really sticky in our country, though.
But I think our framers were very smart in the fact that they made it so complicated and made the power so distributed between three branches of government. And even then Congress, who's supposed to create law, they have two separate houses and it's messy and they have to agree with each other. And you're forcing a bunch of imperfect people to make the most perfect form of government we can.
And I think as the country continues to evolve, you know, one of the questions that we'll have to ask ourselves is are we living up to the highest ideals of the intention of the founders? And I think, you know, sadly, when you look back at the 1860s, it obviously we weren't. You know, we went to war. We killed each other. And in the aftermath, and I think this is something that Langston says in that last speech, you know, the South lost the war on the battlefield only to win it in its bloody aftermath. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of truth to that statement.
Well, the other thing that I wanted to bring up just as a kind of a final wrap up is that it was amazing to me that the issues that led to the Civil War and then that were fought over in this story, the things that were settled, the things that specifically were not settled, came back in throughout the entire Jim Crow period, came back in the 1960s and the Equal Rights, and then are now back still with us today. And that the actions, yes, we can talk about huge mechanisms and policies and governments and documents and constitutions, but the actions of a few individuals can have such a huge impact on such a long swath of our history.
And that'll bring us to the Booth episodes, because the action of one individual
precipitates
changed the course
of
this. Our country, because we had an opportunity to fix the sin of slavery at that time, and the country could have been monumentally different if Lincoln had been in office and he and Stanton had worked to enact the change that they were wanting.
Me being slightly more of a cynic than you, I don't know that any human being could have stopped what the South was attempting to do in the wake of the Civil War. But what I will concede to you is that if there was one man that could have done it, it is absolutely Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, I think just in terms of his already position in history at that time, his political power, the power of his personality in that moment was such something that Edwin Stanton just did not have. He was not popular in any sense of the word.
He was not likable.
He was not likable. He was not a people. He was not a man of the people in any way. And so, again, it's a perfect setup, Eric, as you said, because the actions of Edwin Stanton and this story, which have been fascinating. So thank you guys again for bringing it to light and to sound, I guess. Is that a thing, for bringing it to voice?
Sure.
Putting voice to it. You put voice to it, and I appreciate it. But there's another side of this story that we haven't heard anything about. And that is the side of the story that we're going to explore. The conspirators, what happened with Booth, kind of the territory of the very first play that you guys wrote around this, that now got abandoned when you fell in love with Edwin Stanton as a character, but you've gone back in and given us great episodes on this conspiracy, and I am very excited to hear it.
And that's actually one of the therapeutic things that's happened through the podcast, is that all of these scenes that, because it's hard when you're a writer to take a character you wrote and rip them out of a play, or take a scene that you love and rip them out of a play.
Not for me.
But I'm saying we miss those things.
Of course.
The cool thing is, through this process, a lot of that stuff that wound up on the cutting room floor ended up being used.
Well, that is a great place for us to start when we come back for the Inside the Episode, episode 14. Thank you guys for being with us through this incredible journey, for listening to the story of Edwin Stanton, for getting us to hear. All of you who have listened to us this far, don't miss episode 14. And then as soon as you're done with it, come right over here to the Inside the Episode and find out more about how it all came together. I'm Rob McCollum with Stephen Walters and Eric Archilla. As always, thank you to Stephen Walters. Thanks all of you for listening. We will talk to you after episode 14. And if you'd like to support this kind of storytelling and ensure that we can continue to tell more stories like it, please support us at patreon.com/1865. Members there get advanced access to episodes, bonus features, and a free copy of the soundtrack album. That's patreon.com/1865. I'm Rob McCollum. Thanks for listening to 1865 Inside the Episode.